Welcome, welcome. Good morning. So there's, as is usual, this is this one of the things. So while you're taking the exam, one of the things I do is, as I'm walking around and looking at everybody, being an observant, geeky physicist, I do dumb little statistics. How many people are left-handed? How many people are right-handed? How many women do we have? How many men do we have? What are the ratios? Turns out this class is absolutely average on all of those. Almost exactly 10% of you are left-handed, although there's a left-handed cluster over here. And and, you know, the number of women that we have versus the number of men in the class is about typical. Another thing that's interesting to observe, the first class after an exam, almost inevitably the attendance is down, particularly around and particularly around exam time this time of year. I know all you guys, this is not the only exam you've had. You had other tests, you're about to have other tests. So let's get into it. I have not finished grading all of the exams yet. I'm about two-thirds of the way through. So for those of you that have not gotten an email yet, don't panic. Nobody has. But I will email you all of that information over the next couple days. I'm really hoping, fingers crossed, to get them done before Wednesday morning so I can hand them all back to you on Wednesday. But I am going to go over, out of the first few problems, I am going to go over some common misperceptions, because there are always common misperceptions and they immediately relate to what we're going to talk about. So happy birthday to Olivia Newton-John. I can't be the only one. Come on. Famous singer in the movie Grease with John Travolta. Martin Heidegger. Heidegger was a boozy bigger. Took a drink under the table. Winsor McKay was actually one of the very first animators. He drew a comic called Gertie the Dinosaur in the early 1900s, which predated Walt Disney and all of that stuff. Johnny Appleseed, Serena Williams. Today's Nobel Prize winner is T.S. Eliot. He is not a physics Nobel Prize winner. He won the Nobel Prize for Lit. Who here has ever heard of Eliot? He's one of my favorite poets. Among other things, and very appropriate for this class, wrote The Wasteland. So National Pancake Day and National Situational Awareness Day. Look around you for the nearest exit. Yes, the windows count. So who here thought that the exam was easy? Who here thought the exam was Who here thought the exam was, oh my God, what am I doing in this class? Okay, so I understand all of that, and that's perfectly fine. There is, today, it's funny because I looked over my slides and then I realized I actually want to start going off, not off of the slides, not working off the slides. I am actually going to work on the table a little bit more today than as usual, partly to talk a little bit about at least the easy misperception that I got from one of the first couple questions in the exam, and then immediately start connecting it into what we're really talking about, which is Newton's laws, statics. So all of you people that know statics, this is going to look really boring. Trust me, for the people that are not in statics class, you got to get it, okay? And then start moving on to extra additional forces and go from there. So in the exam, and for those of you that didn't get this, you know, kind of pay attention, because it is a fundamental mathematical technique that is important. In the exam, I had this problem, right, where I had a few, you know, vectors. And this was kind of an A, a B, a C. And I wanted you to calculate some stuff about a D equals A. You know, first rule of thumb, be detail-oriented. This was a minus sign, and some people calculated it with a plus. A minus B plus C. A I wouldn't call it common, but I certainly saw it in at least five exams, and it worries me a little bit. So I said calculate the magnitude of D, right? And it was on several exams, perhaps even as many as 10 or so. What people did is they calculated out, okay, here's the length of A, and I calculated out the length of A. Used the Pythagorean theorem and calculate the length of B. Used the Pythagorean theorem and calculate the length of C. And then they would write down, oh, the magnitude of D is equal to A plus B plus C. Or A minus B plus C, whatever. That's still wrong, okay? You have to add and subtract vectors as vectors. You must add and subtract their components and then use the Pythagorean theorem on the final vector to figure out the magnitude. You cannot shortcut it by just adding lengths together. Well, it's not necessarily less work, but the obvious counterexample, you know, and it is a relatively obvious counterexample, is let's say I've got two vectors, you know, of length 1 in each one of those directions, right? Length 1 pointing that way, length 1 pointing that way. Their sum, their vector sum is 0. But if I add their lengths together, I get 2. And the final vector is not length 2, the final vector is a 0 length vector, right? And the same thing even went, you know, it was even funny because some people even calculated the angle of D as the sum of the various angles and went through, you know, all of that math. Okay? This is the type of stuff that will get you a frowny face. Because there is a deep misperception here that when you see addition and subtraction, it's always the same thing. And it's not, right? Vector addition is different than scalar addition. And calculating out final angles, you must calculate the final vector first and then figure out the magnitude and figure out the angles. If you don't get this, right, if you don't understand or if you don't know that technique and be able to apply it, not only will this class kill you, the next class will certainly kill you because 232 is all about vectors with electricity and magnetism, all about vectors. And statics will kill you because statics is all about adding vectors together to be equal to 0. As, you know, some people in statics already know, right? So make sure that you use the appropriate technique, and that is you calculate the x component, ax minus bx plus c, x and dy is equal to ay plus, minus dy plus cy, right? That will get you a happy face, okay? And then, of course, once you have this, and you can calculate the angle is kind of, you know, the arctangent of dy over dx. And you have to draw your triangle and add 180 degrees if it's necessary to do that. And the total distance d, as I wrote on the overhead, was dx squared plus dy squared. Okay? Those are the correct ways to do vector addition and subtraction. Are there any questions about that? Yes, I understand. There's, for a lot of you, you may be going, oh my God, but there, for some people, needs to be reiterated. And as a teacher, it's my job to reiterate it. So, this type of math, in this problem, I actually did this all with distances, right? All the units were meters. and something was a distance that way, and something was a distance that way, and something was a distance that way. Because displacements are vectors. So are velocities, so are accelerations, so are forces. A lot of different things that you're working with in this class and in physics are vectors with different units now. Don't make it overly complicated. Don't look at the vector and say, oh, it's got to be a velocity or it's got to be an acceleration. There are lots of different types of vectors with lots of different units. You manipulate them the same way. That does not mean that you can take a position vector and add it to a velocity vector and add two things with different units. Sorry, physics just doesn't work that way. So always add them together with the same units. So let's take this and take it a step forward or apply it to problems that are applicable for what we're talking about now, which is Newton's laws, right? So Newton's laws, right? So Newton's laws, you know, the first law is objects move. Think of the ball rolling down the plane. An object at rest will stay at rest unless acted on by an external force. An object moving at constant velocity will move at that constant velocity unless acted on by an external force. The second law is much more easily encapsulated. As an equation, right? Some people, I think in statics, you'll even write down something like this. And in statics, nothing is moving. So all the sum of the forces is equal to zero. And then the third law is that every force incurs an equal and opposite force. The way that's commonly phrased, it may inspire you to think that nothing ever moves or accelerates, right? If every force has an equal and opposite force, well, that's right. Every force from something encounters an equal and opposite force back upon itself. This is kind of like the exchange principle. And I try and emphasize the exchange in Newton's third law, because whenever two things are exerting forces, they're kind of exerting those forces on each other. But when you figure out a problem, you're telling a story about one of the objects. Oh, that force is acting on that object. Or the other object. The exchange force, the backwards force, the equal and opposite force from the first object is acting on the second. In class, we did the classic example, kind of a simple example, of a force acting on two boxes horizontally, right? And what's happening is, what's the question is now, okay. Well, if I just look at box M1, it's actually encountering two forces, right? It's encountering this force, and it's encountering a force from two acting on one. Right? There's a pressure, there's a force between the two boxes. So if I just look at box M1, there's that situation. If I look at box M2, There's only one force acting on M2 horizontally, and that's the force from box 1 acting on box 2. What Newton's third law says? Newton's third law says F21 is equal to F12. The magnitudes. Notice I didn't draw vectors on there. Their directions are actually opposite. Equal and opposite. But now I can figure out things like accelerations. Okay, and both of these guys, physically now, you can look at this problem and draw one other equality, and that is, okay, both of these boxes are going to accelerate. I'm moving them on a frictionless surface, and they're accelerating at a certain rate. Whoops, A. And both of them are going to accelerate at the same rate, right? They're going to move together. If one doesn't accelerate at the same rate as the other, they're either getting squished into each other, or I push on these boxes, and oh my god, that other box comes flying off the end and goes racing down them. No, right? They're going to move together. That's physically how the movie runs. Huh? Newton's Cradle is a classic example of this. I've actually got a beautiful movie of a Newton's Cradle. Maybe I'll show next class. So the accelerations are both the same for these guys. So I can now, you know, talk about these boxes kind of independently and apply Newton's second law, right? So this came from Newton's third law. And now applying Newton's second law to box one. So I got M1. And times the acceleration 1, which is just m1 times, you know, the acceleration. There's no special acceleration. This is the acceleration of both boxes. And I can apply Newton's second law here. F net is equal to F. So what's the net forces here? Well, it's let's call this direction positive. So this is F minus F21 is equal to M1A. That's fine. The net force here is F12, which is M2 times A. That's M2, A2 really, which is M2A. The acceleration is the same. So far, so good. Notice that the F really only appears in the M1, right? The only way it comes through to the second box is that F12. I'm going to try and figure out, you know, this F21, F12 thing. They're both the same. They're both equal. So that means, you know, F12, which is equal to F21, is equal to M2 times A. Okay, I'm going to use that over here and plug that in. So I got F12 is equal to F21 is equal to M2 times A. So this F is equal to, this F minus, this F21 is M2A. Well, that certainly makes sense now, doesn't it? The force I have to apply is the force to accelerate both of the boxes together. If I work this out with real numbers, what I can do is I can also find out what F12 is. But notice that the force between the boxes, just like I talked about last class, right, a week ago, the force between the boxes is not this net, is not this total force I'm pushing on, using to push. It's only the portion of the force needed to accelerate the second box. So So the force between the boxes is less than the force that I have to apply to push both the boxes together. You could even do a little experiment with moving boxes. Stack two moving boxes together, full of books. And I move down here, I have 5,000 pounds of book boxes. Stick two of them together and push. Where it's going to crumple, oh, it's going to happen. Where it's going to crumple, though, is not between the two boxes. Where it's going to crumple is where I'm pushing. Because I have to push with the force to push both boxes. Between the boxes, however, there's only the force necessary to push the second box. That is a direct application of Newton's third law. So far, so good. And yeah, I'm starting to shift a little bit into working through with just formulas and not saying, this is 10 newtons and this is 3 kilograms and 5 kilograms. Once you can do it with the symbols, you can do it with the numbers. So far, so good. Okay? So that's kind of a standard example. The other standard example, and it's a standard example here now, where I've got a tension on a line, and I've got the force of gravity. Right? This is the magnitude, this is not the vector version, so don't try and write in minus 9.8 meters per second squared in here. Because this is not a vector. I already accounted for the signs with the arrows and the vectors here. This is positive. Let's say. Okay, and the acceleration here, well, I've got these two different forces. So use Newton's second law, the net forces is equal to T minus mg, and that's going to equal ma, the acceleration of this elevator or box hanging off a line, whatever it is. Okay, so if you want to find the tension, you need to know the acceleration. If you want to find the acceleration, you need to know the tension. If this, let's say the box is not accelerating at all, what happens if A equals zero? Well, if A equals zero, then the tension is just the weight of the box, which makes sense. Makes you feel happy, right? However, if the acceleration is positive, the tension is going to be bigger than that. Pulling the thing up, you know, I stretched the line. At some point, the line might snap. Oop, gotta be careful that we don't accelerate the elevator too fast. This may seem obvious. I'm gonna make it a little harder in a second. If I let the thing go, or let's say I accelerate downwards at the speed of gravity, or at the acceleration of gravity. If I accelerate downwards at the acceleration of gravity, this A is minus g, and those two end up canceling out, and I get no tension in the line. Makes sense, too. I let gravity do all the work in accelerating the thing down. Okay? This is kind of the classic simple example. That is not what you might see on an exam. Oh, that was a bad laugh. Sorry. I am so sorry.
That was not an evil laugh.
That was not an evil laugh. Yeah. Okay. What happens if you have, you know, things hanging, right? So. So now I've got, you know, many things hanging together. And now I've got different tensions in each one of those ropes. You better end up with an answer that intuitively makes sense. And the intuitive makes sense answer is the tension in that top rope is the weight of all of these guys together. The tension in that middle rope is just the M2 and M3, the weights of those together. And the tension in the bottom rope is just the weight of M3. But let's make, what happens if we start making this an elevator? What happens if we start accelerating it? You have the Newton's laws to save you. But all of a sudden, you're a little worried. Because with the boxes, remember with the boxes, the force between them, which is like a tension between these guys, was not the same as the, you know, the pushing force, right? So you gotta be a little bit careful, and you gotta systematically apply Newton's second law and Newton's third law throughout the entire problem. So let's say this is a trio of elevators and they're all accelerating in that direction. And I've got the force of gravity kind of pulling things down. And what I'm going to want to do is probably break this down. I can break this down lots of different ways. None of those ways is wrong. They're just different ways of approaching the problem, okay? Because I can look at each box individually. I can look at all the boxes together. That's the easiest thing to do, and the thing I recommend is always look at the smallest independent element first, if you can. Let's just look at box 3. Okay? In box 3, we know is accelerating. With acceleration A, upward, its net force, I'm going to use the black because the blue is kind of fuzzy. The net force, let's draw box M3. There's tension 3, and there's its weight. That's all it is. T3 minus M3G is equal to M3A. Okay? So that gives me right away the same thing that I had in the previous problem with one elevator, right? Because this looks just like the elevator problem, M3 times A plus G. So far, so good. So if I'm accelerating this thing up, the tension in that line is just the tension necessary to accelerate M3. Let's look at M2. Okay. M2, now it's two forces pulling down on it, and one force pulling up. Force pulling up is tension T2. Force pulling down, one is the tension T3. Equal and opposite force through the tension of the line, and this guy's weight. So now I can say the net force is what? It's plus T2 minus T3 minus M2G. And what's Newton's law say? The net force is equal to the mass times the acceleration. And that's the mass of only this item, box 2. Okay? So what's tension 2 then? Tension 2 is equal to tension 3 plus M2 times G plus A. Well, what was tension 3? It was M3 times A plus G. So on and so forth, right? So the tension in this line, just like, you know, a train or something like that. The tension in this T2, in this middle rope or middle cable, is the tension that's needed to act against gravity and accelerate both masses 2 and 3.
Makes sense.
You'd almost guess that, but we can calculate it, and the technique to calculate it is an important technique. Okay? Fundamentally, what I'm showing you here are a couple of techniques. One is, draw a diagram with all the forces. Label which direction is positive. You label which direction is positive, draw a diagram with all the forces, break the forces down into components, which we'll get into in a second when we start doing this in two dimensions, and then apply Newton's law. You'll have all of the equations and components necessary to solve pretty much any of your statics or standard dynamics problems like this. Okay, so far so good. And then if I calculate T1, what do you think it's going to be? M1 plus M2 plus M3 times the acceleration plus gravity, right? That total mass times gravity is the total weight of all of this stuff just hanging statically. Now if I accelerate it, I distribute that force to accelerate all these boxes through all the different cables too. The other technique that I'm showing you here is direct application of Newton's third law. This T2, or this T3 here, pointing down, is the same as this T3 here on mass 3 pointing up. So I'm looking at two different objects when I talk about this, so getting the sign of that T3, you really have to kind of zoom in on the object and see exactly which direction that force is acting on that object. T3 is acting down for M2, it's acting up for M3. That's the way ropes work. Yeah?
If you were to draw a force diagram for a response, would you have 3 force vectors pointing down or 2?
I would just write, so it's a good question. Let me show you. So let's go to just box M1, okay? So for box M1, okay, the way I would draw box M1 is I just look at box M1. Just looking at box M1, there's a T1 pointing up. What's the tension falling down on box 1? T2. Box 1 doesn't know about box 3 or any other crap down below. All it knows is, oh look, right here, there's a cable pulling down on me with this T2 force. And I can use that T2 force from the previous problem to figure things out. And then there's gravity as well, which is M1g. Okay, but it's completely local.
When you start deriving your algebra from there, T3 is included.
Yeah, exactly. Right. I mean, this T2, remember, was really M2 plus M3 times A plus G, right? And all of that, then you start seeing all of that stuff, but it's all transmitted through that tension. Okay? And if you take this to the logical extreme, right? I mean, these are 3 individual masses. I mean, if you just have something like a regular rope, this kind of explains now how a regular rope works, too. I can look at any individual little piece of that rope, like one of these masses, and all I see is, locally, stuff pulling me up and pulling me down. Just like the slinky. And when I let go of the slinky, I cut one of these ropes. And what happens? Well, when I cut one of these ropes, locally in the slinky, it said, oh, I don't have that force pulling up on me anymore. I'm going to accelerate down, but only locally. And it took a little time to transmit to start falling and loosen up its tension on the next section of slinky to release his force and let him fall, and down and down and down the entire slinky it went. So deeply underneath this is exactly kind of how all solid objects work under tension or compression for you Mech-E types. Transmission of forces throughout a solid. And you can use calculus to do all of that. And it's beautiful and wonderful and outside the scope of this course. Thank you. Okay? So these are all kind of applications of Newton's laws. So let's see, what's a good... So far I've been using, let's draw a little catalog of forces. Because so far I've used examples where either I give you the force pushing the boxes, or it's the force of gravity. So there's, you know, some forces are given. That's fine. Some forces are gravity. And that force is, you know, the mass times the acceleration of gravity. And remember, what's the mantra? Gravity is a force. Do not put the acceleration of gravity on this side. Gravity is one of your forces. Okay, so far so good. Now, given forces and gravitational forces will only get you so far in the world. I'm leaning against a wall, and I can tell you, it ain't the gravitational force keeping me from going into this wall, or keeping the wall from coming into me. Okay? There is deeply underneath everything, I'm compressing this wall a tiny little bit, just like, you know, I was talking about spreading forces down a rope, and this wall is certainly compressing me a little bit. But it's kind of, you know, you can imagine it's kind of springy. And so the next natural force to look at is springs. And in your case, because this is introductory physics, well, I got a spring, just like the slinky. And I stretch it out, it wants to compress again. Okay? So a spring at rest has no force. Okay? If the spring is completely relaxed, I'm not compressing my hand or the wall, I'm not pushing against it, there's no force, it's not pushing me. When I start to compress the spring, though, it's going to push back at me, and it's going to push back at me the harder I compress it. The springy pulls on me the longer I stretch it. Okay? So the spring force is really, and this is called what's a restoring force. Is minus some constant, we call it K, it's oftentimes given, times the distance, and here the distance the spring is stretched or compressed from rest. Okay? I mean, I can even plot this thing, right? This is the force, and this is the distance. If it's not compressed or stretched, the force is zero. So that negative K means that this thing is a negative slope, and I should really draw that properly as a straight line. You get the idea. It's called a linear restoring force. It's proportional to how much I stretch the object. I stretch or compress the spring. So for springs, the force is equal to minus kf. We add that to our little inventory of forces that we know about. A little bit later on, we're going to talk about the real force of gravity, which is inversely proportional to the distance between the objects, right? F equals gm1 m2 over r squared or whatever. More complicated than these forces. Don't worry about it yet. Just use that as, you know, gravity of Earth's surface. We're going to talk about friction next, but I'm going to do a quick spring example first. So this is a little background on spring forces, and I'm going to keep my little inventory of forces over here. The one last force I'm going to get to before the end of class is the force of friction. And then we're going to have a real kind of good little assembly of force Legos that we can put together to build all sorts of different problems and figure out different problems. Now let's take our box. Our elevator that was on a cable. And let's say that cable now is not just a cable, but a spring. A spring constant K. Sometimes you'll be asked to calculate it, sometimes you'll be given it. Okay? So now we can draw the forces on M1, right? There's a our little force diagram. The force of gravity is pulling down. And some force is pulling up. Well, this is, let's say this is the positive y direction. And so the force of the spring. Let's say I position this thing so that the spring is at rest. This is just before I put the green onions on the scale at the supermarket, or something like that. And then what's going to happen is this is going to stretch some distance, delta y. The force from the spring is pulling up. Okay, and it's minus k times the displacement, delta y. Now you might, it's easy to get confused with signs here because of that minus sign from the spring. But quite honestly, you have to notice that here, delta y is pointing down, right? The string is getting stretched. Spring is getting stretched. So the force of the spring is pointing up. That's what that minus sign means. Is that the force is opposite to the direction of the stretch. That's all it means. Don't overcomplicate it. Don't overthink it. Okay? So that means that the force of the spring is pointing up. I accommodated for the sign here. Okay, minus k delta y. Remember, delta y is going to be negative, so this thing is really a positive thing. So use Newton's second law, net forces. Okay, some of the forces, well, there's a minus k delta y, and there's a minus m1g. And let's say I put the green onions on the scale and let it stretch the exact amount so that all the forces are balanced. So, oh my God, it's a statics problem. There's no acceleration. Acceleration is zero. So what I have now is I've measured kind of the mass. So if I solve this now, this means that minus k delta y is equal to m1g. So the mass of the object is minus k delta y over g. Okay? I just weighed the object. You must put in the delta y being negative here, because it's in the negative direction. And then that'll cancel out that negative sign and give you a positive mass, which makes sense. But really, it's the same approach. Draw the force diagram, label all your forces, go down your little shopping list of forces. Oh, okay, I know the force from the spring. Oh, okay, I know the force of gravity. And then use Newton's second law. Yeah. This is the magnitude. This is now the vector. I already accounted for it. Okay. And this is an incredibly important point for the way that I teach this stuff. And I get that it can be confusing. Okay? And that is, remember it from the very outset, I said the magnitude of g is 9.8 meters per second squared. And to get the sign right, look at your drawing. Look at where it is relative to, you know. And I got the sign right here. That's where the negative sign came in. Okay? Because I drew the force diagram that way. You don't have to add in, and if you add in other negative signs, you're undoing the good work you did by drawing the picture. So far, so good. Yeah?
If you were pulling the mass down and getting it in acceleration, the force diagram would stay the same, it would just be your second-law equation.
That's right, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, because, well, let's rephrase that slightly. If the object was accelerated just on its own, let's say I hung it there and I let it go and it's accelerating downward, then yes, I can figure out the acceleration downward. So for example, let's say just the moment I put the green onions in the bin, the very initial acceleration, the thing isn't displaced. The spring isn't stretched at all, so it has no force. So the only force is gravity, and those onions, that thing is accelerating downward at the acceleration of gravity. The moment it starts doing that, it starts stretching the spring and gets pulled up a little bit, and then it sags. And you can figure out exactly how it sags using some calculus if you want and stuff. But that's a dynamics problem where acceleration is not even constant anymore. You haven't been given those tools to figure it all out, okay? But I can look at the little bit of time just as I put them in, just at the beginning, and yeah, it's falling, it's accelerating, and you're absolutely right, okay?
There is a very strange spring constant.
So it's. For those of you that are physicists, or for those of you that plan to be scientists, okay, almost this mass and the spring thing, we'll get into it later on at the very end of the semester. It's called a simple harmonic oscillator. Almost everything in the world can be reduced down to simple harmonic oscillators. If you look at almost any set of forces, as complicated as they are, if you look at them very, very locally and zoom in very, very tightly, it looks like a little parabola pointing up or a little parabola coming down, which is an oscillator, is like a spring. Okay, so the simple harmonic oscillator comes up again and again and again and again. It's one of those things that's just universal absolutely everywhere. I won't go into all of the glorious, god-awful details with you guys at the end of the semester about it, but trust me, it is much deeper than it looks. And pendula, which are a little bit like simple harmonic oscillators, are even more complicated in the sense that they can even be chaotic. Complete aside, okay? Back to this, and this is looking at a spring and looking at a system. Now we're going to make it a little bit interesting, and we're going to stretch this now to two dimensions. And we got our little shopping list there. And I'm starting to run out of room on my board, man. Oh, no. Okay. Let's draw a typical set of axes. Another classic standard example. Uh-oh, it's the inclined plane problem. So I've got a mass on an inclined plane. Okay? And what I'm gonna do before in class, well let's go over this let's just look at the inclined plane problem again and review it real quick. Because it's important and you'll see it on the homework. And you've seen it on the homework probably already. Okay. So I want to find out what the acceleration of the block is down the plane. And we say that the plane now is frictionless. And we try and point out the forces. Let's draw the various forces on the mass. And I've got my little mass here. And there's a force up from the plane or up from the floor, something called the normal force, keeping it from falling into the plane. And then there's the acceleration of gravity. Okay. Mg. That's our little force diagram. That's all the forces that are acting on this thing right now. And remember, Newton's second law is a vector equation. So I have to add these forces together in a vector way to get vector F net. Figure out which way my acceleration is pointing. Now, in this problem, you can kind of guess, and it's kind of obvious that the acceleration, the thing is going to slide down the plane, man, right? The acceleration is down the plane. If I use this coordinate system, the acceleration is going to have both x and y components. You can do it this way. Trust me, you can do it, and you can calculate everything, and your answer will be right. Physics does not care about your coordinate system. Also, trust me in stating it's going to be more complicated, you know, a little bit more mathematically painful than it needs to be. I will go through that pain with you if you want, but I bet you don't want. Okay? To figure, you know, what you'd have to do is equation 2, right, Newton's second law. There's a Newton's second law in the horizontal, right? F net x, is equal to m1 times ax. And there's a Newton's second law for the vertical, F net y is equal to m, it's not m1, ay. Right? That's what it means to be a vector equation like this. And here, yes, there's an ax and there's an ay, and it's a pain in the butt. So instead of drawing our axes like this, the standard trick, and it is not all that much of a trick, is to draw your axes like this. And if you draw your axes like that, it's a little easier. Not that much easier, but it's a little easier. Because if you draw your axes like this, it's pretty clear that the acceleration in the y direction, I'm not bouncing off the plane, I'm not bouncing into the plane. The acceleration in the y direction is zero. Okay? So that'll make some of this a little easier. This will make this thing equal to zero. I am so anal retentive about my units, but I try and teach you to do the same thing. Now I have to take my little force diagram here and break pieces down. And I did this last class, we'll do it again. Okay, the normal force in the y direction, right? The net forces, well, n only points in the y direction, so n sub x is equal to zero, and n sub y is equal to plus n, right? Okay, n is pointing completely in the normal direction. However, this mg is going to cause some complications. I need to break down the mg into components. Always draw it so that there's a right angle on the opposite side of the thing that you're breaking down, right? And we talked about this angle being theta. So here, I can use SOHCAHTOA again. This component of this force is what? Is the sine is the opposite over the hypotenuse. So this is mg sine theta. The adjacent is the cosine. So this is mg cosine theta. Some of you use a funny little technique I've never seen before where you take ratios of two things. Fine, whatever technique works for you. I just know SOHCAHTOA, and so I know that the sine of this angle is this side over that side. That means that this side is going to be that side times the sine of theta. It's just something that I practiced enough that I know off the top of my head. So we got these two components. So let's look at the y direction first. In the y direction, then the force of gravity is mg cosine theta pointed in the negative direction, right? So I've got this thing is plus n, and then pointing in the negative direction is mg cosine theta. And that's equal to zero. So, and I won't write down the newtons because it's going to get confusing at the end. N is equal to mg cosine theta. So far, so good. That's what I get from the vertical component of Newton's second law. Let's look at the horizontal component of Newton's second law. How many horizontal forces are pointing on this guy, or pushing on this guy? There's one. There's only this component of gravity. So F net, is equal to only this guy. And it's positive because it's pointing in the positive direction, plus mg sine theta. And that, what's that equal to? That's equal to the mass times the acceleration in the x direction. That means that a sub x is equal to g sine theta. Okay, so I've got two nice little results here for the inclined plane. One is that my acceleration down the plane is just the acceleration of gravity times the sine of the angle. One is that the normal force, the push up from the plane on the object, is the weight of the object times the cosine of the angle. Do these make sense? Try a couple of cases. What happens when theta equals zero? An object sitting on a table when theta equals zero. When theta equals zero, the cosine of zero is one. The normal force is equal to the weight. Table's pushing up on the object with the weight of the object. Makes sense. Okay. And sine of theta is equal to zero. The object doesn't go anywhere. It doesn't slide. Because there's no incline to the plane. What about theta equals 90 degrees? Theta equals 90 degrees. The object is not even sitting on the table. It's right next to the table falling to the ground. The acceleration is the acceleration of gravity. I'm in free fall. Is there any normal force? Cosine 90 degrees is zero. No normal force. Okay? So these equations, you know, you can double check them with a couple of different angles, and it makes sense. Good idea to generally do a reality check whenever you box an answer. You look at the answer and say, the number makes sense. I calculated the car's velocity to be 86,000 miles per second. Does that make sense? No. Okay. So a couple of different angles here. Different velocity. So this is a simple inclined plane, in the sense that, okay, we drew this out, just like the box hanging off the line. Now what happens if the thing isn't sliding anymore, but it's connected to a spring? If it's connected to a spring, I have another force here. The minus sign is pointing in that direction. This thing stretched some distance, delta x. And let me write that down as delta x instead. I accommodated the sign because delta x is really in the positive direction. I drew the force in the negative direction, so I got the sign straight. But now what I'm doing is I'm drawing an extra force acting on the horizontal part of this box. And now I'm saying its acceleration is zero. Let's just, instead of hanging your green onions from the weight thing at the store, the little scale at the store is, you know, laying on some frictionless plane. It only changes this picture a little bit. I got my little shopping list. Now I've got a couple of forces acting on this thing. Right? The net forces are mg sine theta. Which is the force of gravity trying to accelerate that thing downwards. Here I'm saying the acceleration is zero because the thing is in balance, the thing is static. And now I've got another force pulling up, and it's in the negative direction. And this is all, that's all equal to zero. Because the acceleration is zero. It's a static case. So I end up getting delta x is equal to mg sine theta divided by the spring constant of the spring or whatever. So for the static case, I can figure out, you know, how far does that thing stretch? If I know how far it stretches, I can figure out k instead. But just the same technique applies. Draw the force diagram, apply Newton's second law. Draw the force diagram, apply Newton's second law. Break everything down into components. Yeah. Because I assumed it. I said I'm hanging this thing off a spring and I just let it stretch until everything is stable, is not moving. The conditions like that should always be given to you in a problem, right? That's because otherwise you don't have enough information to solve it. There's too much other stuff going on. So far so good. We've used Newton's second law in vector component fashion. Break everything down into X's and Y's. And we've started to use our little inventory of forces at starting to add in springs and stretchy things. So let's take a little break. Let's come back at a quarter after, and I'll do some statics problems with you as well. Yeah. Today I have to get on the road, unfortunately, because my fiance's in the hospital. That's okay. So, yeah. I mean, by far the easiest thing is so email me and we'll try and figure out the time. But if you have any specific questions, like about the homework or something like that. Yeah, I mean, if you email me about those two, I can try and type some things too. But I know it always works better for us to work them through on the board. But, you know, we do what we can.
Thank you.
Hey.
So, theoretical question again. Actually, this is more applied last week when I was, we're designing something for a bed, basically a little bed. So, we had to, somebody using the bed, they weren't so the way we were supposed to, we're not supposed to lay on and lift it, supposed to help the side. They broke the screwy pipe motor, and now we need a tiller. We didn't want to run another wire up there, so I said, let's pull the motor. We can pull the motor on the same wire. I have to run another wire on the same motor in series. However, running the motor
I'm sure you have enough current to do that.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Well, it was great because the motors are exactly the same. So the wire size is good for 20 amps. So if you have two motors in series, 24 volts, it's still going to be a 20 amp circuit. However, the thing with motors really rely on voltage up front. And so if one starts before the other, he's going to have more voltage up.
Okay, so
theoretically, what I was telling him was like, okay, so these motors have to be able to push at the same time. What happens if one pushes more than the other?
It's like a balance to the back or something, yeah.
Now, this was the question. And I think I'm pretty sure I'm assuming it correctly. Grab one motor, just in the world of electric. I grab one motor, the other one's going to spin faster. Well, as I apply tension to one, he's going to move faster because I'm kind of giving down resistance. However, when I let off, I'm not going to equalize. I let off, he's still going to go fast. He's still going to go slow, so I can go.
Yeah, I mean, so this is, you know, this is something a little bit.
Neglecting that when naturally taking tension off of an axle, it's gonna automatically go a little faster, but it's not gonna equalize the voltage between the two because he was spinning slow, meaning his apparent resistance is low, allowing more current to fall into the other motor. The other motor is creating a higher apparent resistance, keeping the motor going slow. In order to change it, I have to grab the other one.
Yeah, I mean, motors are slightly complicated things in the sense that it's not just a linear response in the current voltage curve.
Yeah.
It's like your car, right? It's got an optimum torque to deliver power to the wheels. This is the same type of system. It's got an optimum torque to deliver power to the to the turn. And so a lot will depend on the kind of the power response of the motors, which is all sorts of god awful details about how many turns there are for the type of motor and blah blah blah, right? The impedance versus the inductance. It ends up being a where you have to write out the changing current over time and the changing voltage over time. optimize it properly. You know, there's, in just grabbing one and preventing it from turning is, okay, so you're not taking power out of that motor, but there's still some voltage shock across it due to the resistance. So putting those two things just in kind of a blunt series is a little bit of a dance. You know, it's almost like what you want is a capacitor somewhere in the system that takes some of the extra power.
That power pack, but
it's kind of like a clutch,
right,
electrically,
right,
and what it does is it stores some of that energy that gets shunted. It helps you shunt power from one to the other in kind of a graceful way.
Across the terminal. The capacitor has to be equal to the inductance.
So there is, and what it does is effectively acts as an electric clutch.
Right.
So you gotta make sure it's big enough resistance, because otherwise you're gonna fry the resistance.
You'll
have a nice black smell and let out the white smoke. But there's for these types of power motors, I'm not sure exactly. But you already mentioned enough that you can probably figure it out.
Yeah.
If you're handy enough for these types of things.
Well, I was trying to tell the guys who were designing the civil engineering part, which is really just some guy who did welder stuff. I said, look, these motors one way. If it starts to shift, it's going to keep you. You need to create something that just initially keep them going straight. Both drop is the same across them. They will just remain the same across. Otherwise, you're going to have this light between them, and it's not going to do what you want to do, and the customer's going to be unhappy because he's a rich guy on all these talking things. He had like five. So, and I was also relating to like inverter problems where you're taking capacitors.
And in some sense, if you just got both the motors in series with a voltage, from symmetry, you'd argue that both the motors should start at the same way because it's completely symmetric. A voltage shock is a voltage shock. There's nothing special about plus 24 versus prime. You could be ground and minus 24. Okay, so there could be plus 12 and minus 12. The motors have no way of knowing that one is connected to the hot and one is connected to the ground. So all you're doing, so it's a completely symmetric system, and the only reason that one motor might start up and starve the other is that there's an instability in the system.
So that small one, but by a ratio, right? So like, if the instability is 33% more than the other, he's going to cause...
Right, if this guy fires up a little bit faster than this one, he's going to draw a bigger voltage shock, which means he's going to pull even more and starve this one even more. So it isn't a stable system. It's inherently an unstable system when both of them are in series, because the one that fires up a little more will starve the other one out.
So what I was thinking is that's a ratio problem. If he has 33% more.
The way you always solve an instability is damping, which is exactly the capacitor thing, right? If you add a little damping so that if this guy gets too far ahead, there's something in the system that, damps him a little bit. So, whoa, boy. Okay. You know, imagine you have two horses, and you got one horse that's, chomping at the bit, and the other horse that's a little bit slow. You're gonna tuck back on this one a little bit and say, okay, slow down a little. And that's the damping, that's the capacitor. If you have the capacitor sagging that guy a little bit, then the capacitor adjusts to his pull, which the capacitor does because it's about time constant. Then it helps stabilize the system.
So the correct answer, I was just telling them that if we get just did the start, like if you get it so they can't do anything, they can only do one direction. As soon as it goes one direction, they'll automatically stabilize because they're forced to go the same direction.
But you still gotta be careful because if one just binds a little bit, then it slows down.
Hopefully the breaker trips.
Yeah, right, exactly. But if one binds a little bit, then you're going to get stuck again, right? Because it's the same thing here, right? It's like, now you want to whip the horse that's going fast, that's going too slow. Or if one binds a little bit, it's going to drop. They're going to become unstable again.
So better engineering solutions, two well-valued capacitors across the leads.
Yeah, exactly. Capacitors that can take the voltage shot for that, you know, because that's what you really have to do is design a caps to take that voltage shot.
And
does
the capacitors, I would imagine the capacitors should be opposite of the inductance of the motor itself, or does it matter?
Doesn't matter. Capacitor is not polarized.
Well, not polarized so much, but the time constant as it grows.
Oh, yeah.
So if you have more variance, the capacitor needs to be able to hold more charge. So
that's right.
If it's like a strict value or resistance.
Well, you figure out the resistance of the system, and RC is a time constant.
Right. Or in the RL.
Yeah, right. But what you want is a time constant that's consistent with the time constant of the sag and the motors, which is on the order of tenths of a second or something like that. It's not going to be seconds, it's not going to be milliseconds. It's going to be, you know, a mechanical system, so you want a time constant that reacts to that sag. On the order of, you know, letting things settle for about a second. And if it takes more than a second to settle things out, then you have to trip the damn ramp. Get something bound up.
Right. I just don't want this guy who's about to die fly off the bed because he's capable of 500 pounds.
No, I don't think that'll happen, so I hope not.
I hope not. That's insurance.
Okay, it's after a quarter after. Welcome back. Another reason that I'm working on the board on the overhead instead of my laptop is that I later discovered that all of the little math that I pulled up in my overhead didn't copy over in all of the little vector signs didn't copy over in my slides. So I'll redo the slides for the class notes, but you know, here's our little inclined plane ball with the spring and stuff like that, and the spring compressing. So all of that will be posted to the class notes probably later on tonight. So the next thing that we need to cover, just to make sure that those of you that are not taking statics know how to do it, is stuff like statics, right? And stuff, simple enough problems, but problems that combine various things. So the classic problem . Okay, so let's say you want to hang your professor, which, you know, okay, it happens, I understand. Typically this is, you know, somebody rappelling down the side of a building or something like that. But let's play a little hang the professor today at least. And what we want to do is we want to find out, okay, now this is a one-dimensional problem masquerading as a two-dimensional problem, because naively you say, oh, the tension in the rope is just the tension in the rope is what it is. But following all of these prescriptions, right, you should really calculate out, okay, at a various point anywhere along this rope, there are two Newton's laws things according to equation 3, right? According to Newton's third law, the tension in the rope anywhere is transmitted along the rope. Tensions get transmitted around pulleys as well. And then if you just look at your poor professor hanging off the edge, of course there's a tension, and of course there's the acceleration, the gravity. Tension minus mg is equal to ma is equal to 0 if I'm hanging there and not falling or not rising, whatever it is. This is a statics problem, and so the tension, of course, is just equal to my weight. Notice, however, that I still wrote the y component of Newton's law here. And if I figure out this stuff here, this, you know, two equal tensions. If I look at some little bit of this rope, it's going to have a tension pulling that way. And it's actually this tension is this tension here, and the tension pulling that way. Whoops. I just should say F net, not with the sum. And so this is kind of, you know, again, almost somewhat obvious. The tension all along the rope is the same, and that's my weight. But notice that I'm writing Newton's second law here using horizontal components, and writing Newton's second law here using vertical components. And for both cases, I'm still doing the standard technique, which is draw the force diagram. Draw the force diagram, break down everything in the components, and then apply Newton's law. Okay? Yeah.
Did you write Newton's law as acceleration of zero?
Yeah, because it's a constant situation, a static situation. So, yeah, so right now we're working with statics, and in statics, nothing is moving, nothing is accelerating. That's a subclass of kinematics, a subclass of these types of problems. So there is, however, you know, this can get complicated very quickly. You look at this and you think, boy, that's easy. Okay. That's easy. Let's hang the professor a different way. Because hanging him over a cliff is too easy. But hanging me over a cliff, I might grab onto the cliff, I might climb up the cliff. You know, I don't have fingernails, but I am really tenacious about things. So instead, what we're going to do is we're going to hang the professor over a gully, okay? And so I've got two, you know, trees. Then what I'm going to do is I'm going to hang, you know, my poor professor here. Exactly. Good way, you know. At least I'll be hanging there choking, going, yeah, that angle is about 20 degrees. Okay. And let's say, for these purposes, let's use some units, right? So I happen to be about... Now I have to admit something that I don't know my weight in kilograms off the top of my head. But I did just weigh myself this morning, and I stayed at a Holiday Inn Express last night. So let's see, So let's say I'm 100 kilograms, okay? So mass of the professor is 100 kilograms, which is pretty dang close, okay? Let's say that this is 5 meters and this is 5 meters. And let's say that this angle here is 20 degrees. Okay, and now you can guess what I'm going to ask. I'm going to ask, what's the tension in these lines? And from the symmetry of the problem, it's sure, you know, you can guess pretty much that if both of those angles are the same and both of those distances are the same and all that stuff, both of those tensions are the same. You can also guess that you should work out with a friend or work out for yourself what happens if these are not the same, because a sneaky professor just might ask that on a midterm, where the problem gets a lot more complicated because it's not symmetric anymore. But let's do the symmetric case first, the simple case. Okay? So we're hanging the professor here from these various lines, and now we need to start drawing force diagrams and applying different components of things. Certainly I'm hanging here with a weight mg pointing down. And let's draw my axes x and y. Okay? And let's look at this point where all three of those forces meet, because that point is a point that's very natural to draw all of these forces from. So that point is there. There's a tension pointing up at 20 degrees. There's a tension pointing up at 20 degrees. And then there's a force pointing down, which is this tension of the rope that I'm hanging from. We know from the elevator problems and all of that stuff, it's my weight. Mass times g. Okay? So this is the force diagram of all of those things. And now, remember, to do Newton's law, I have to break all of this down into x and y components, because I can only use Newton's law in component form, horizontal, vertical. So let's figure out what these components are. If there's a tension here, and this is 20 degrees, okay, then this component here is going to be soka toa, right? So the sine is the opposite, so that's t sine 20 degrees. And this is t times the cosine of 20 degrees. Over here, it's exactly the same. Right? So I've broken down both of these forces into their x and y components, both of these tensions. And this weight is just vertical. Easy enough. Now I'm going to erase that macabre scene for a moment. Remember, that distance is 5 meters. It actually doesn't matter. But we never even use it. All we care about is applying Newton's second law to this point. So the net forces in the x direction, what are they? Well, I've got one tension pointing in the x direction at plus t cosine 20 degrees. I've got another one pointing in the minus direction at t cosine 20 degrees. Okay, well, that's zero kind of naturally. Okay. I'm not moving horizontally. That point there isn't moving horizontally. I could have even written these down as kind of T1s and T2s. And this equation would tell me from all of the symmetry that T1 had to equal T2 for this to be zero. So the horizontal reinforces something that I already guessed. Those two tensions are equal due to the symmetry. Okay? That equals to zero, and that makes me happy. What's the net vertical component? Well, I've got these guys are both pointing up, which is the positive direction. So I've got a plus t sine 20 degrees there. I've got a plus t sine 20 degrees there. And I've got a minus my weight. And all of that is equal to zero because this is a statics problem. I'm hanging I'm hanging, man. Don't leave me hanging. Okay, so now that means that 2t sine 20 degrees is equal to mg, or the tension in the line is my weight divided by twice the sine of 20 degrees. And if you figure that out, that's 100 kilograms times 9.8 meters per second squared divided by 2 times the sine of 20 degrees is 1,433 newtons. So about 1,430 newtons. You may not have a gut feeling of what a newton is, neither do I, but that's what the tension in each one of those individual lines is, okay? But it's not that bad. It's kind of like the stuff we've already been doing, except now the picture is a little more complicated and you need to be more careful about taking components. But other than that, right down after you write components, that's all the hard stuff. All the rest is, okay, the X stuff, the Y stuff. Get the signs right because of the arrows relative to my axes up here. That's it. Everything else is just math. So far, so good. Okay? That reminded me, since I just did this on my computer, and I know some of you have taken advantage of my recommendation to use Google Calculator. And Google Calculator is a wonderful and lovely thing, but you need to be careful about any tool that you use that you understand what it's doing. If I type this and take not the sine of 20, but the sine, right. If I don't type degrees, I get a different answer. Because Google, doing sines and cosines, expects radians for the number, because you're scientists and they're scientists, and all the scientists work in radians. So if it's degrees, just like any other unit, you need to type degrees. There were some people that got radians and degrees confused on the exam, and it's either because your calculator was accidentally set in radians, but you typed in 60 sine or 30 sine, or you accidentally did this silly little thing with Google Calculator. Whenever you take a sine or a cosine of something in Google Calculator, there was another one, right? A10 of minus 1 over minus 6, right, is going to give it to you, and they even always tell you it's radians. If you want it in degrees, give it in degrees. Say, give it to me in degrees, okay? So, and the arctangent was actually minus 6 over minus 1 in the exam, 8.5 degrees. So statics problems, this kind of thing, this type of problem, okay, maybe this line is at 30 degrees instead of 20 degrees, and you have to use the horizontal stuff to relate the two different tensions. That's fine. Maybe we'll go over that next time. But this is about as hard as it gets with statics. Process is draw the force diagram, break all the components down into break all the vectors down into components, and then use horizontal and vertical versions of Newton's law with A equals zero. That's it. You can do almost any statics problem, except those involving torque and rotational motion, which we'll get to in a couple weeks, get to later in the semester. There is, okay, I think that's probably good for today. Let's, next time we'll get into friction. I'll bring exams for you. And we'll talk about friction, energy conservation, and get into work.